Take a light on your right, bro.
Welcome to episode 54 of the Swerve City Podcast. This is a very special episode with a very special guest. We've been saying that a lot this last couple of episodes, but this probably might top
this
it
one.
All. This one tops
nice.
It all. Yeah.
Do you know how long I've been waiting to go to Swerve City? It's been a long time, man.
Well, we're going to Swerve City and the kingdom and the castle of Chris Jericho. This is very special. Like, there's two worlds combining. Like, last time we talked, I was on the, you know...
Talk is Jericho.
We had a great conversation there. I wish it could have lasted longer. We could have talked for hours.
We'll get chapter two.
Yes, but... Right. So, we're going to, like, do a little remix version. He's coming over to the Swerve City Podcast. Man, TZ, finally getting these two worlds combined. Some genius minds in music. So, this is going to be awesome time.
And we're actually at my house.
Beautiful theater.
We're going to set up outside the dock when it started raining.
Florida.
Which I knew exactly what you were doing at that time. I was ribbing you guys. You're carrying your big box of equipment all the way down to the dock. It started raining.
Well, I deserved it. I was like, yeah, carry it up to the dock. Now bring it back. Now go upstairs. Yeah, we deserved it. He deserved it, man. So, this is a very special time, man. What's going on, TZ?
Man, I'm feeling great, man. You know, anytime you're in your GOAT house, you're in the GOAT house, it feels amazing. I'm blessed and I'm thankful to be here, bro. We've come a long way, bro.
We've come
a long way. Starting the beanbags and being in a GOAT house.
Beanbag. not as good as
that's
that
one. That's a love sack.
Yeah, no. Ours was like...
No, we have space, but I ain't sitting there with you, bro. I love you, brother, but I'm not sitting there with you, bro. No.
But, man, first of all, congratulations. Fozzy just went gold. He's got a gold
record. It was really, really cool to grow up watching, you know, MTV or Much Music is what it was in Canada and always seeing, like, you know, Ozzy Osbourne talking about gold discs and platinum discs on the wall. And I was like,
that's the standard. You know,
you've got the gold disc. Yeah. So, and to get one in 2022 is really, really hard because you know, a lot of people don't really buy music, but it's also done by streaming now too. So combination of those two numbers, able it to go gold. So we, got the disc, the plaque, big giant plaque in the mail. You take it out. It's like one of those moments where you just got to go, man, this is really, really cool.
Yeah.
You know, put it on the wall, send one to my dad, you know, find the people that have been close to you that, you know, that you want to share it with. So, yeah, it was a really, really cool moment for us.
Especially starting where Fozzy started. It was like back in like early 2000s, you know?
Yeah.
So you've seen the transition going from like store-bought CDs, going into FYEs and all the, you know, the TV stores, local vendors, to going into the transitioning into... streaming music and stuff, especially in metal and in the rock genre. Talk about that. What was the transitions and the changes you were seeing?
The first record we did was on Megaforce Records. Megaforce was the record company that signed Metallica, Anthrax, you know,
Anthrax.
30 years prior. And it was also Palm Records, which is a guy called Island Records. Sorry, Island Records owned Megaforce, whatever it was. So Chris Blackwell owned Island Records, and U2 was on Island Records. It was a big, you know, I think Bob Marley was on Island. So there's kind of some big conglomeration. So our first record deal was like literally a six-figure deal. Because in 2000, that's what bands were, even low-level bands like ours with no buzz at all, just who was in the band, were making those types of record deals.
You could see
that get down slower and slower to where it's like, you know, 15 grand or 10 grand. But back in those days, even still, you were still making a lot of money from the deal itself.
It was wild to me that, like, you were doing everything you were doing on TV as far as the WWF and, like, transitioning from WCW, but you still had to prove yourself in the music industry, still being, oh, we're still new. You still got to prove it in this industry.
I think you know that, too. I mean, just because, and there was a little bit of a misconception at first that just because I had a big fan base from wrestling that they would all run out and buy a Fozzy record. And that's not the case. And nor should it be. I mean, to really have longevity as an artist, as a band, you have to prove yourself. And I think we've had to work twice as hard to get people's respect, even to this day. But once we got it, you got it for life. Like even I was talking about the radio game and just building your song to go to top 40, then top 30, 20, to get to top 10. And then that's when the real work starts if you ever want to try to get to number one. And even still, we still have a little bit of prejudice because Chris Jericho is in the band. Mm-hmm. He's a wrestler. It's like we have five consecutive top 10 singles on the radio. It's like, how much more do we have to prove ourselves that it doesn't matter if Chris Jericho's a wrestler? It doesn't matter if Slipknot wears masks or Kiss has makeup or AC/DC is a guy in a schoolboy suit. No. Who cares? It's either good music or bad music once the gimmick wears off, which takes about the amount of half a song before you're like, okay, this gimmick is no good.
Right.
So, but that's just how to do it in wrestling as well, or anything that you really want to make it in. You have to just stay in it and prove to every doubter that you are the real deal. And when you can do that, it's when you get to the next level.
Absolutely. So, you know, when you started, you got to think, because it's funny because you're the mentor when it comes to that, because with him working, being a wrestler and getting into music, and then me doing music, getting into wrestling.
Yeah.
It's been, I understand, because I hear it and I'm like, man, sometimes you put stuff out in the wrestling audience and just crap on it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then sometimes it'll be the other way around. It's really a different thing. So I got to commend you, because I always say this, me and him always say this,
yep.
To be able to survive in music and wrestling and be able to thrive in this opinionated genre, these two opinionated genres,
right.
And for you to be successful, has a lot, not only about your character, but it's a lot about you not giving up.
Well, and I appreciate it, because you can't give up. Like when, right. I was a kid, yeah. I wanted to be in a rock and roll band and I wanted to be a wrestler. And people were like, yeah, that's ridiculous. You'll never do that.
Choose one.
If you choose neither, you'll never do either one. You're too small for wrestling. I mean, you know, how are you supposed to be in a band? And I just never worried about that. You know, I read Arnold Schwarzenegger's book, and I actually follow his newsletter that he puts out on email.
Oh, wow.
And he said when he was 14 in his small village of Graz in Austria, I want to be a movie star and I want to be the best bodybuilder in history. And people are laughing. What? Ah, mm-hmm. You'll never either one of those things. And to me, that I'm like the Arnold Schwarzenegger of that genre, of like not caring what people think. And listen, I am in for the hard work. I get it. It's not going to be handed to you in any way, shape, or form. And I've lived that vibe up until now, you know, 30 odd years later. Because if you can do it, and when you make a success of yourself against these odds, then you're unstoppable.
Yeah.
Then you're really dangerous. Nothing can really turn you away from really wanting to do something. So I always say that no is a four-letter word. People say no way too easily. They throw out no like a curse word.
Mm-hmm.
Don't accept it. Don't ever accept no. If you really want to do something, go and do it. And if you have the talent, then make it happen. And don't look back.
Let me ask you this. The dynamic of your band members, because, you know, if you've been in the wrestling business so long and you know how to navigate through it, you know who you like, you know, who you're friends with or you're not. But your band members, you grow a different kind of love with them, traveling on the road, hitting those buses, however you guys travel around. It's just you guys. You guys come together like a family.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. I want to give a shout out to those guys, too. Tell me a little bit about your band members and give them some love.
Rich Ward is my partner in Fozzy, and he's probably one of the greatest guitar players in the world and is now starting to get that recognition. He always had, I mean, Dimebag Darrell from Pantera loved Rich, and Zakk Wylde loves Rich. But he and I have been in this since day one. We're the only two guys that were there from the start.
Gotcha.
And then our other guitar player, Billy Gray, has been with us for probably 15 of those years. And bands are hard. They're hard to keep together. You know, it's hard to keep everybody's level of passion and desire up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, there's personality shifts and changes. And you know, a band, you got to have a Mick and Keith. You got to have a Steven Tyler and a Joe Perry. You got to have an Angus and a Brian Johnson. So you have to have two guys that are kind of the leaders of the band. And other guys that understand the place always fit in and always rock. Other guys that maybe want to do more. You got to stay what you do best. You know what I mean? It's like in wrestling. Not everybody's a ring general. It doesn't mean you can't be a huge star.
Yeah.
But you don't try and be a ring general if you're not. I mean, you know, it's just the way that the business goes. So it's hard to keep a band together, but when you get the right collection of guys, you know it.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, like, because you're spending weeks together on a bus, we call it the submarine.
You gotta get to know each other, right? You gotta get to know each other.
Yeah, and the show is, you know, 2 hours, and the rest you're sitting there, you know, smelling each other's farts, basically.
Yeah.
And you have to have a great collection of guys, because one bad apple literally spoils the whole bunch.
Right.
And that's not just for the band. We're a five-piece, but we also have five crew members, your front of house, you're the guy who does your sound, your tour manager, the other techs,
it's a family.
Your bus driver. Everybody has to be cool. Yeah. And so that's the dynamic, that the hardest thing about being on the road and being in a professional band is that.
What do those guys know about Chris, the artist, that the wrestling guys, your friends, and the people in the locker room don't know about Chris Jericho, the wrestler?
I think it's probably a lot of similarities. There's just a lot of drive. And like, I don't have a problem promoting. And that's the thing. Like, there are so many people in wrestling and in music and in every aspect of show business that will do a project, spend months on it, and then not want to promote it. And I never understood that. Like, hey, AEW calls me. Hey, could you do some interviews for Minneapolis tomorrow as we're filming this?
Right.
Of course. It's I have a world title shot. I'm in the main event. I want to promote it. If I sell 10 extra tickets or get 10 more people to watch the show, well, then that pays off. Same with Fozzy. You know, I was telling you earlier, like whenever we go to a city that has a rock radio station that's supporting Fozzy, I'll go in earlier in the day, 12 o'clock, pick me up. We'll go to the radio station in Columbus last week, stay there for an hour, then head to the venue for AEW. So, and they always say, thank you so much for coming. So many bands don't want to come in. And I was like, that's absolutely unacceptable. I mean, I heard Mick Jagger on Howard Stern before this last US tour that they did. You know, let's say if Mick can still promote, obviously he's not promoting a lot of places, but he still did the Howard Stern show.
Yeah.
Like, you have to promote your stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can't get too much of a big head to go, oh, it's fine, because there's too much entertainment nowadays. There's too many places for people to consume media, wrestling, TV shows, movies, whatever it may
be. Your phone.
You got to be out there promoting. So mm-hmm. I never have a problem with that. I think that's something that the Fozzy guys know it. And the AEW guys know it, because if I don't do it, then somebody else will. And somebody else probably can't promote it as good as I can. So I'll be out there doing it.
You know, it's funny you say that. You said that because it's a great point you said that. Because I'm subscribed to Howard Stern's channel. So I don't see a lot of newer bands on there. Every time I'm watching, though, I see how I have people in there. Billy Corgan, Smashing Pumpkins, Jane's Addiction.
Sure.
There's Metallica. They're in there. They're performing for Howard. They're promoting what they have going on. Even if they have nothing going on, they're there.
That's the top period.
They understand how important it is.
Right.
So the Chili Peppers, when the new record came out. Now, they're not doing every single bit of media, but you got to do some.
Right.
So that's my point. Not all of us get on Howard Stern every time a new record comes out or every time there's a big show coming up, but every bit counts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I can't do it, then one of the guys in my band will do it. Or, you know, or sometimes with AEW, I can't swing this one, call Swerve to do it, or whatever it may be.
Right.
We got to do it. You know, you got to do it as a team. And that's very, very important. I think a lot of young guys and girls that come into show business don't understand that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like David Lee Roth said, the best advice, here today, gone later today. I mean, it can go by like that. And you think of the list of people that have come and gone in all aspects of the business that we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's very fleeting. So if someone wants to talk to you to promote whatever it is that you're doing, you better well be promoting it and doing it.
Yeah, a prime example of this was like Kevin Gates coming in to do
the
spot. But like, his album came out like maybe a couple weeks prior to that.
Yeah.
And he was just on a media run, going on Revolt, going on like Complex, going on doing all these interviews. And it was like, hey, man, want to come in and we can promote your album on AEW?
Yeah.
The nice little fun thing.
Absolutely.
Went viral. Guess what? People went back to listen to his music.
And even for me, like I didn't know Kevin Gates. I wasn't familiar with him. Saw him, good guy. Took a picture. They sent the picture. I put it up on my social media stuff. Kevin Gates, new record. Like, hey, listen, every little bit counts.
Everything.
Now you have Chris Jericho's fan base. They go, oh, we saw him at AEW. Let's check him out. And that's how it builds.
Yeah.
So anytime you get a chance to do any type of promotion, especially nationwide promotion like that, you got to jump on it.
Yeah. Like, there's a lost art to that. And now, honestly, in 2022, there's so many more unique ways to promote.
Mm-hmm.
We have all these different like ways, and like we have so many connections in AEW.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even music and all the other things. Like, some people are going off to do movies and television shows and radio. Like, that's like, some people are posting pictures and getting like 30,000 likes on them. I'm like, this is like all valuable ammunition to fire up who you are, the product. Like, build yourself to something that's, you didn't even think was believable.
Well, and once again, you mentioned kind of starting in the transition phase with music in 2000. Yeah. I mean, magazines were still very, very important. You know, radio stations, I never realized how important rock radio was until we started getting played on rock radio. Still very viable. But you look at the old school as newspaper ads and in stores. Like, there's not a lot of stores to do in stores in.
Mm.
So the new way of promoting is, once again, like you said, if you build up your social media enough. Like, I have 12 million followers on all the various platforms. That's a good start. And then...
Start.
Well, that's what I mean. You at least can control your own narrative and promotion.
Right.
You know, and it gives you a little bit of an edge to what it was before. You don't have to worry about, well, how much does the radio spot cost and what time are we getting played at? And, you know, now you still want that if it exists, but it really... I don't hear a lot of ads on the radio for albums and stuff like that, maybe concerts and everything like that. But still, you got to kind of keep it in-house and build and grow as much as you can, because you could always, always, always count on yourself for that promotion.
You know what's crazy? I was talking to a mentor of mine, a music mentor of mine. He told me, he said, the problem nowadays is everybody's trying to be Slash or Michael Jackson. They want to drop an album and then it disappear. Like, you can't That's one person.
Yeah. I tell you what, if Michael Jackson was still alive, his way of promoting would be different.
Yes,
he had to evolve.
Remember Guns N' Roses, you mentioned Slash, you're probably thinking about Axl Rose as well. They did a record called Chinese Democracy.
Right.
It's famous in the rock world because it literally took 14 years to make. Mm-hmm. 14 years, I think, I don't know, like $20 million or whatever the hell it was. Came out in 2009, and Axl refused to do any promotion for it. When I say refused, zero. Didn't do the Tonight Show, didn't do MTV at the time, whatever, nothing. That album came and went so fast because there's no one to promote it. You've got to be out there to promote it. So even Guns N' Roses can't get away with that anymore.
Yeah.
Nobody can. Yeah. You know, and even when sometimes artists drop a record like the day of, that was the kind of the cool thing. I think Kanye might have done it.
Beyonce
did it. Avenged Sevenfold did it.
Drake just did it.
It bombed for Avenged because there was no build up to it. They're like, "What do you mean? There's a new Avenged?" And then everybody got mad at them because they didn't promote it at all. So there's a fine line. You always got to keep in mind that people need to know that your music is out there. If they don't know it's out there, how are they supposed to be able to find it and listen to it?
Let me jump in there real quick. Chris, just an occasion. Can you, like, look at the this camera? Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, like, this is interesting. It's an interesting topic, and this is an interesting, like, we're in just this weird age of just, like, everybody just thinks, like, it's more the clout than the actual content of the music, of the art of it. So it's more like the antics. It's more of the, look at me, we're jumping out of a plane. And then buy my album, like, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
Whatever. And, you know, or it's more like controversy is like getting all the, that's the promotion more towards the music or the product in itself. And I don't know if that's the right way for a lot of artists. Maybe it is, maybe for some, but it's just like, once again, it's that select few that can just get away with like just dropping something at midnight and not saying anything.
Not saying a word,
but some people can just like garner up a lot of just noise and clatter. And then you go, and but now they got to check out what's going on.
It's like I said earlier, like you can't rely just on your gimmick to do all the work for you. And that goes with promotional tactics or whatever it may be. Like the music has to be great.
Yes.
Especially now, because once again, we're talking about all the different platforms that you can watch television or movies or whatever. It's the same thing. I mean, you can go on Spotify and find probably hundreds of thousands of unsigned artists. And millions of signed artists. So what, you know, and I understand the publicity stunt and that idea, but the music still has to be great. Now more than ever.
Yeah.
Because there's so much good material out there. So gimmicks are important. It's still show business. You got to have that.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can go back, you know, Kiss wouldn't have lasted 50 years if the music wasn't good. You know, I mean, if you can't put makeup on a record and put the record on the turntable and go, oh, this is amazing. So I think it goes for all of that. And so, you know, it's the reason why, you know, okay, NWA, gangster rap, and they're gangsters, and, you know, they're sure they're gangsters, and it was a cool story, and the movie was great.
The controversy was great.
But the music is killer. Like, it's great stuff.
Still stands
the test of time. Yep. You know, it's like that.
And that marketing spoke for itself.
Go back to Run DMC when they first came out, if you want to talk more about rap. And it's like, you know, being a suburban Canadian kid, we didn't really know what rap music was, but you see Run DMC because of the Aerosmith connection, which was a gimmick. But then it's all about the sweatsuits and the Adidas. Yeah, they look cool. You could dress up like them, but it was the music that was really great.
Yeah.
That's what really got me when you put on, you know, Peter Piper and the Raise Hell and those type of tunes, and it's just like, this stuff is killer, man. Like, I love this. It was just exposed this energy, this whole new form of music that became because of the rock connection, which was a gimmick, and then the way they looked was a gimmick. But then after that, it was just like, oh my gosh, you know, NDMC is amazing. Same thing with Beastie Boys. Oh, they're a white group of rappers, you know, how good could this be?
And then with Def Jam,
with Def Jam, and then Fight for It to Party. So there's Kerry King from Slayer plays the solo, so there's a metal thing.
Yep.
And then you go listen to the record, and it's like, I remember hearing Girls, and it's like, this is the most annoying. Girls, and you're like, this is super annoying, but it's so catchy. And then there's some coolness to it. And then Paul's Boutique comes out, which was the most sampled record of all time before there was such a thing as a sample, where you're hearing all of this stuff, and it's like, I mean, this is just genius. where did this come from? These are the three white guys who were, you know, doing a video puking on each other at the party. This is not funny. This is just killer.
Yeah.
So once again, the gimmick is a good way to get your foot through the door, but then the music has to be good. And if the music is good, then you'll start to attract real fans.
For sure.
One thing I want to bring up as well, and it brings over to your career, right? And from watching your career with music and what you do now, and I know you get this question in different ways, but you've mastered the art of timing, and it almost needs to be studied on how you've done it. Because, you know, even you always say, you know, I watch Lonnie Panther, and you say try something new, but just the way you've mastered the timing, and you say, you know what, you know, this might have been hot 2 months ago, I'm just gonna switch it because I want to, and you'll just do it.
Yeah.
And to have that kind of self confidence to do that, and to see how you've been able to master timing, because people can change stuff all the time. You can change your clothes, or the next album, or the next time you come back from a break in wrestling, you can change your look and stuff like that. But the way that you've done it on timing has been amazing. Just seeing how you've said, like you said, you know what, go a little bit of that. When you see something, you know what, it's time almost, to switch it up.
It's like almost surveying the landscape.
Seeing everything from the outside. It's right.
Great, but obviously reading the room.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's something I've become very good at, is reading the room, which means, is it time to change something up a bit? You know, and I always let the... Something I've been saying recently that I really, really appreciate this thought is you let the story lead you. You don't try and lead the story. Meaning you go in the direction of what, not necessarily what the audience is doing, but what you feel that the audience is feeling. And kind of like you have instinct after doing this for so many years, like, this could be better. It needs a little bit of a switch. Like if it's like a screw, you need to tighten it a little bit more. You need to loosen it a bit, or maybe let's go to another.
Just hammer down on this.
Exactly. That's right. Yes. Yeah. So it's very much feel, instinct, timing, but most importantly is letting the story lead you. I mean, the perfect example I've talked about a lot recently is, you know, Eddie Kingston and I, when we first started doing our angle, the idea was we would end up as a team. Eddie and I would, but as we were going along, and then I had some medical issues, and then Eddie had a broken orbital bone, and then he had mentioned something to Santana Ortiz that Jericho's the one who's keeping you back from winning the title, and I couldn't work with Eddie because he was hurt. Well, maybe I could do something with Santana Ortiz because they're kind of, you know, locked in with Eddie, and there's a thing there, and then, like, I never wanted to end the Inner Circle, but then this idea came of Danielson talking about taking Danny Garcia with him, and our whole angle was built around Danny Garcia and 2.0 attacking Eddie and then attacking me, and then Eddie and I getting in a fight because we're not trying to protect each other against them, we're trying to get revenge. And then it's like, why'd you come down to save me? I didn't come down to save you, I came down to beat up the guys that beat me up, that just coincidentally beat you up. So then taking Garcia away from them, I thought that would really screw 2.0. you got to keep those three guys together. And Santana Ortiz were kind of Eddie Kingston. And I was like, wait a second, what if I just do a shift and start a whole new faction with these three guys? And then keep Jake Hager, because he's never turned on me. And then Sammy's got the title, so he does his thing. And then suddenly we've got a whole new war. And then just coincidentally, Regal comes in, Blackpool Combat Club. They're beating everybody up. And guess who's in the Blackpool Combat Club?
Danielson.
Moxley and Danielson. But Moxley and Kingston, who are...
Good friends.
The shit wrote itself. Jericho Appreciation Society versus Eddie and Santana Ortiz and the Blackpool Combat Club. To me, I saw it like months before we even did it, just because, like I said, the story is taking us there. The story is leading us there. We don't have to do a damn thing. And that's how that all worked out. And that's why we had, like, gosh, probably 2 months of great matches so far, which led to Moxley and I in Minneapolis tomorrow night. Yep. I mean, all of this stuff happened for a reason. That's amazing. If we would have been stuck on it, Eddie and I have to end up as a team, none of it ever would have happened.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? So just feeling like it's not right, this is the square peg in the round hole. Whereas this stuff, I'm literally like, it's a Ouija board. Just let it write itself. Done. Here it is.
No spell cast.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we're always talking about. This. We're playing video games. We're playing video games. We talk every day. So we're always planning, scheming new things and new progress. So we always talk about, like, the guys who are frontline and the master sniper. This is the master sniper we learned.
Yeah.
There's the guys in this world that when war comes, they just come with the shotgun, they just want to bust through the doors. Front end. Come to in life, they just want to bust through the doors. And then you got the guy that has no problem put on his camouflage,
laying down,
has a sniper, sits in the
war
wing,
happen,
and he waits.
Take the shots when you
and
need.
And he knows the person's coming out the door.
Right.
But he's patient enough to wait.
Yep.
And that's what we relate that to you with your longevity and time. He's like, you know, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to chew some chips. Jesus, come out the door eventually. You know what I mean?
That's a good analogy, man.
Right.
That makes sense. Because once again, I mean, timing really is everything.
Right.
Yeah.
It really is. And sometimes, you know, I try and tell some of our younger guys this. You can't have it all, like, now.
No.
It takes time. It takes time to for the story to be right. It takes time for the audience and the fans to not accept it, but to be intrigued and hooked by it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, it takes time as a performer. You know, you have to have... Excuse me, you know, like I look back to when I was maybe undisputed champion, I think 2001 is when it was, you know, oh, you beat The Rock and Steve Austin, saying, yeah, I did. Was I really ready for that? Man, I mean, it was as good a time as any, but it wasn't like if it was now, you know, it was the first kind of taste of being, you know, a main event guy, being a champion, but I wasn't really the champion. I wasn't the top guy in the company. That didn't happen until 2008, which was 7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Think about 7 years of experience.
Yeah.
It was too early for me, but I was the best guy for the job when Triple H was hurt and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But that's why it kind of ended up the way it did. It was fine, but it wasn't killer. It wasn't huge money-making business. Nor do I think it could have been, because it wasn't ready yet.
I always say that about certain acts. I'm like, some people need to learn how to be a main eventer and a champion before they get the championship.
That's right.
You need to learn how to
That's right. Just
walk
because you
that.
Win the title doesn't make you a main eventer.
No.
Just because you win the title doesn't make you the top dog in the company. It really doesn't. And it took me a while to learn that.
Right.
You know, and it also took me a while to learn that some guys don't need a title. It's great to have one, but when you get past a certain point, it's like, titles are awesome. So, but if you're not ready to have it, it's not right. If you don't necessarily need it, it's always good to have it. But it's also good to know that you can be an island on your own.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I'm at right now. Yes, I could be the world champion, and everyone would go, "Oh, sure, of course." I could still be in the main event and be a main event guy without the title.
Yeah.
That's the next step that you want to get after you become a really great champion, is get to that point where you become completely bulletproof. Championship, no championship, win, lose, or draw. You just become
you just become
a guy.
Yeah.
The guy, like a draw. A legit cornerstone of the company that you work for.
That's what I had a conversation with Shawn Michaels about that.
Yeah.
And that was one of the biggest things when he came back for the second run.
Right.
He said he had more fun playing on different heartstrings rather than just me versus you, who's better, or me versus you, championship in the middle. He said his mind just took off.
Yeah.
Because he was just like, you could put me anywhere and it's going to be main event quality with anybody because in an angle.
Well, one of the greatest stories of all time, in my opinion, is Jericho versus Michaels 2008.
2008.
You know, started in April and went all the way to October or November. It wasn't supposed to, but the story was so amazing.
Unsanctioned.
You know, his wife
amazing.
Got caught up in it and ended up working up to the world title.
Yeah.
It was never supposed to be the world title. It was just Sean and Chris. Let them have a match. It'll be good. And we were like, well, what do you got coming up next? Nothing.
Nothing.
What do you got coming up next? Nothing. Well, then why are we rushing this? Let's see what we can do with it.
Right.
And that's when you become, like I said, that was the best story of the year on Raw. Then I think Edge and Undertaker were doing their thing on SmackDown. So these two tentpole stories that ours became about the world title. I'm not sure if theirs did or not, but ours became about it, but only towards the very end.
Yeah.
The first 6 months of it, there was no world title involved at all. It didn't matter. And that, to me, is the real secret. Because wrestling, you know, newsflash, it's awesome to have great matches. It really is. But it really doesn't matter. It's connecting with the audience.
Yep.
It's making them be interested in what it is you're doing with the stories that you're telling.
Absolutely.
Then the great match is a byproduct of that. But I would go out on a limb and say that it's better to have a okay match, not a stinker, better to have an okay match with an amazing story than a great match with no story. I really feel that at this stage of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think wrestling fans might not even know that, but they're always more hooked when there's something behind it other than just a great match.
They feel it, but they don't know what they're feeling.
Exactly. They don't,
they don't know.
And you could go on Dynamite sometimes and see some nights when everyone's on a roll, you see three or four like our pay-per-views. I mean, my goodness. I think Forbidden Door, and I think the last one before that in Vegas, and the one before that in Miami. It was just five or six, like four-star or five-star match, whatever that might be, there's so many great matches. Okay, which ones have the best story? Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that stand out the most.
So you've worked for, you know, the great promoters in Japan. You worked for Eric Bischoff, Tony Khan, Vincent Man. I was talking to him in the car because he's in the prime of his career. He's starting to extend to this next level. You've been around so long, you're working for different people. What is something yourself, though, that they say, you know what, I appreciate what they're telling me, but I'm going to go out here and I'm going to do this because I trust myself. What is something when it comes to even if your bosses or whoever you have a certain vision, but when you get in that ring, you might have a 360 and go with what your gut feeling is. You know, tell me a little bit about, you know, the times that you've had to do that in your career. We say, you know what, I'm going to feel what the crowd is saying and do what I feel is right.
I'm pretty good at kind of predicting it beforehand. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So usually when I have a gut instinct and a thought and a plan, it usually goes the way that I think it's going to go. And it's different now. I mean, obviously we have a lot of creative freedom in AEW.
Yeah.
In WWE, I did as well, but it was much more regimented and it was kind of more based around the way Vince wanted to do things, which was have everything kind of mapped out promo-wise as well. I would still write the promo with a co-writer, with Brian DeWertz or with Jimmy Jacobs or whatever, but it still always had to get approved by Vince. Right. You have to prove this.
Yep.
Every match you did, you'd have to tell your agent, let's say it was Michael Hayes, what you were doing, and they would have it all written down. AEW's not like that, you know? And who knows, WWE might not be like that anymore either. It's a new regime there as well. But I really enjoyed coming to AEW. And also the transition was New Japan, where you didn't have to tell anybody what you were going to be doing, just what the finish was, and just go out there and do it. And I remember the first live promo I had with AEW was Fight for the Fallen in Jacksonville in Daly's Place pre-pandemic. I came out and attacked Hangman Page and then did a live promo after. And I was like, okay. Yeah, everyone talks about how great of a promo you are and you think you're pretty good. Mm. Let's go back to the drawing board. There's nothing written. What are you going to say? What are you going to do? Is this going to be any good? Do you remember how to do it? And I remember that promo was real nerve-wracking in a lot of ways because I was like, I'm not going out with anything. I'll go with the bullet points of what I want to say and I'll go from there. And of course, it went great because it's what I always did prior. And that's where I was like, okay, now I'm on a roll here. And I think that's why AEW came out of the gate so huge, because you could tell the difference right away. Like these guys are just saying things from the heart. They're not using strange terms and saying platypus dung and things that Vince would want you to say. And
you'd be surprised how many acts over there do prefer the script, because sometimes they just want to come in and just like, okay, what am I doing?
And I get it, because if you don't have those improv skills or that confidence and belief in yourself, it'd be terrifying to go out there. It's like you and I could go, and I'm sure you could do it, but even if you couldn't, even if you never done it before, we could go have a match right now and call it all in the ring. I know how to do it. It's easy, fine, no problem. You're the good guy and the bad guy. Easy money. Some people would be terrified of that. Mm-hmm. Probably have never done it before in their lives and wouldn't know what to do. So once again, we are kind of transitioning. You know, my generation of guys were kind of at the last rung of them, where you used to just call everything in the ring, literally. Mm-hmm. And then when more high spots started coming in, kind of in the mid-90s, going to Mexico or going to Japan, you would have to call it all because guys didn't speak English.
Yeah.
You know, or call some of it.
Yeah.
And then when you come back to the States, not everybody's calling the whole matches because you've only got 5 minutes on TV. You don't have time to call it the way you want. You have to have it regimented. So each year that went by, the old school way, I can tell you right now, I remember the very first match I ever had with Lance Storm. We had 3 months to go over it together because we were in wrestling school together. Mm-hmm. And going over it meant, here's high spot number one. Let's practice it again. Mm-hmm. Here's high spot number two. And that was basically it. The rest of you just went out there and wrestled. I remember it was a 10-minute Broadway, and we ran out of things to do. So we were just like, I'll roll you up again, and I'll roll you again. Because we never even called. So we did our one big spot. We did a big spot. And then being young guys, you run through all your moves. And 2 minutes remain. It's like, well, now what do we do? Lock up again.
Start from the beginning.
Yeah, you know, most people now, if you had 3 months to go over your match, would have every single thing. It'd be this. It wasn't like that. And then I remember guys saying, why are you going over your match so much? You literally went over like a minute out of the 10 minutes, but that was too much.
Right.
So, you know, I still have that experience to be able to do that. But as the years go on, it's like you mentioned, people from NXT won't even ever meet Vince McMahon. People that come into business now will probably never learn what it's like to call a match completely in the ring. And, you know, it's kind of sad because there is an art form to that as well. But it's just the way things have changed.
Yeah. Talk about the Vince McMahon retirement. It just happened like last week, I believe.
Yeah.
We're just seeing the first ever post Vince McMahon era Raw pay-per-view and SmackDown.
Yeah.
You see people coming back that were just like, that was Triple H's guys and hires.
Right.
So, like, now it's like, where do you see the product going now? And where do you see the talent actually learning at this point? Because you're not getting that Vince McMahon.
Yeah.
Like he had his Vince isms, but there was a rhyme and a reason we didn't know.
Yeah.
We didn't necessarily know exactly why we're doing, but then later on you'd be like, I get it. I don't think you're getting that anymore.
I can go back working for him for 17 years, 18 years. And obviously, like you said, there's some Vince-isms and Vince foibles that don't make sense.
Right.
But I did learn a lot about the psychology of the business and how to be a star and how to conduct yourself, how to be a true main eventer, how to be a money draw. And I think the pros, if that's the right word, the pros of Vince leaving WWE will be seen very quickly. As you can see, there's a lot of changes right off the bat. They're very refreshing and this kind of thing.
Lots of in-ring time.
Lots of in-ring time.
Yeah.
I think the cons, no pun intended, of Vince leaving won't be felt for a few months, maybe more, 6 months, a year.
I would say 2023.
You know what I mean? Because there's a lot of things that Vince did, just little things. And I know people bag on him for his recent booking and all that stuff. And obviously there was a habit he had, but there's... Those guys that are the true main event stars are legit stars. They're legit stars. You can spot them a mile away. I mean, look at the difference between Drew McIntyre now prior to the last run that he had. Vince worked with him to make him a top guy, top star. Same with Roman. It's completely different now than it was, you know, before he turned heel. You know, Brock is a babyface. I can tell right now that Vince worked with him as being a babyface.
Oh, you can spot it.
I can see it. And because... Tough guys usually, and Brock's got a good personality, but tough guys usually don't ever want to smile. I mean, Triple H never wanted to really smile in the ring.
True.
Babyfaces smile. I mean, I watched Total Recall last night with Schwarzenegger from 1990, and the best parts is when he's making jokes and laughing, and, you know, it's like, that's part of being a badass, is you open that door of personality.
Door of Ragnarok.
There you go, right? So I think there's a lot of that, and listen, a lot of those guys are working in Vince's image. You know, Stephanie's obviously been trained from day one. Hunter's been trained from day one. So there's all of Vince's principles will probably still be used, but there's something to be said. Like, you know, I could be in a band with Eddie Van Halen and we're in Van Halen. He's the greatest guitar player in the world. He quits Van Halen. I bring in, you know, Steve Vai, who's just as good of a player, but he's not Eddie Van Halen. Mm-hmm. He's not a genius the same way. Vince is a once in a generational genius. Now, people can watch this and go, you're standing up for him for us. I'm not saying anything outside of the ring or whatever. I'm just saying from what I learned about the business from him and Pat Patterson, which I think
was another once in a generation.
Yeah. And I think Vince learned from Pat too. And I think, you know, learning in that era, it's something that will end up hurting in the long run and by no fault of anybody's own. It's just that you know time moves on, and that's one of those guys that saw the business differently from anybody else, and it would be great if he would still be able to be there to consult, but I don't think Vince is going to consult anything. I think that when he, you know, decided to leave or was asked to leave, whatever the story is, I don't think he can be a guy that can hang around on the outskirts. I think he's just gonna have to go and find something else that he loves to do.
Are we moving more and more further away from those core things that those Pat Pattersons, these genius minds, like even the Briscoes and all these guys that are like, you know, just wrestling across the board as far as television wise?
You know, I mean, I'm a hockey fan. I've really gotten into football over the last few years. But for hockey, for example, the game changed.
Yeah.
It does. It changed. Like my dad played for 10 years, 67 to 77. My dad can tell you how the game changed so much from the 70s to the 80s. As a fan, I can tell you how much it changed from the 80s to the 90s, 90s to 2000s, 2000s to now. It's just the way that sports evolves, entertainment evolves, music. You know, man, I sure do love, you know, 80s glam music. I wish every band sounded like Motley Crue and Poison. It's just, it'll never happen again.
You can't play that again.
You can't play that. It's changed, right? action movies. I wish there was no more CGI. Too late, you know. Once again, Total Recall. It was all
like makeup.
It was all makeup,
prosthetics,
general effects. It was great. CGI has changed that. Wrestling's the same, in that we have a whole new attitude of what wrestling is.
Yep.
It's very much based on the athleticism, because it's so over the top, dynamic, and amazing, which is great. But I still think the crux of wrestling, and it has been since the 30s, is character, personality, and connection to the audience. Now, I could be wrong about that, except for I know I'm not. There's always characters. I mean, you look at Darby Allin. When he first came, I'd never heard of Darby Allin, never seen him before in my life. And Tony wanted us to work a championship match in week three. We got to find something. I said, what about Sonny Kiss? He said, let's do Darby. I'm like, okay, let me watch this Darby. I'm like, who is this guy? He tapes his hands behind his back and all this crazy stuff. And he wanted to do it. He goes, oh, I got this idea that, you know, you tape your hands behind my back. I'm like, why would I tape your hands behind my back? Is it a no DQ match? And I'm, you know, my veteran mind is like, well, it has to be a no DQ match, or else why would I do this? And then I was like, you know, get your head out of your ass, man. It's something that you've never seen it before. So how many people have? Mm-hmm. So we did do the no DQ because that gave me a reason. And then this guy just, you know, it was ridiculous, all this amazing stuff that he did. You know, and it's so funny, too. What was the finish of the match? Darby climbs to the top for the coffin drop. Yep. Jake Hager comes down, pushes him off. He ends up in the lion tame or whatever it was. I got in so much trouble for people going, how can you, as the champion, have to cheat to beat this Darby Allin? It's like, because he's so good and I'm a bad guy, that's what helps getting him over. So point being is that you see these new guys and it's still the connection. People were dressing up as him in the crowd. That's why after we did that, I started noticing. Same with Orange Cassidy. Who is this guy? I hate this gimmick. It's stupid. Take your head out of your ass and he's over. Why is he over? And you start understanding it.
Surveying the landscape.
Exactly. Reading the room. That's why kids dress up as him. People love him. So, you know, you still have that connection with the audience. It's still the most important thing in wrestling. And to this day, I think I can start trying to impart that into people's minds. The same way that Nick Bockenbill did to me in 1992 when I did a TV taping with him. He goes, you're really good.
Nope.
Oh, generator came back on. There you go.
Hey.
You're really good, but you do too many moves. And I was like, what does he know? Nick Bockwinkel, one of the all-time greatest ever. Of course I was doing too many moves. I was 21 years old. I see the same thing now. And anytime you tell a young guy that, they think the same thing that I did. Yep. But then as you start going, I remember Jungle Boy, he's like, just a couple weeks ago, man, after that, before we had our first match, I didn't get what you were saying. And after we had the match, I realized how easy it could be. That's like a medal of honor for me. Mm. Because it can really be easy. And that's what people relate to, and that's what people really feel when they watch wrestling. So I will keep...
You did the same with me.
Same thing, right? Yeah. Yes, the first match that you had, they had a conversation. We haven't even worked yet. But to see that, I was going, it's going down the wrong route, because this personality is worth way more than roles or whatever it was we were talking about. And to me, I was right, because look at where you're at now. Such a transition, such a difference. It's only been 2 or 3 months. You know, once again, we had a whole... And you worked WWE for a while, but I don't know how many people had ever told that to you. Mm-hmm. People need to hear these things because you have experience. And you can't teach experience. It's the one thing you can't teach. Mm-hmm. And it's at a premium in AEW, because when we first started, once again, there was a whole group of guys and girls that had never been on national TV before.
Yeah.
And if they were, it wasn't live. It's a whole different ball of wax. So those principles still matter. And those are the principles that I learned from Pat Patterson and Vince and those type of guys.
Wow. So you look at, like a microcosm of your career, and you put all this together. There's always somebody that pushes you. There's always somebody that pushes you. Maybe they keep you on a certain level. Somebody you watch. Maybe it might be the other guys. But, you know, I know you mentioned Lance Storm earlier. And who are some of the people, even now or back then, that, you know, you said, you know what, I'm going to watch this guy. But this guy keeps me on my game. Mm. Like, maybe like a rival. Maybe one of your best friends. You know what, this guy can't have a better match than me. That one person. There's always that one guy.
Back in the day, or
even now.
Well, so back then, I mean, Lance was such an amazing athlete right out of the gate. It always drove me crazy because I felt like if I couldn't do these Marvel athletic moves that he did, that I would never make it, and I couldn't. He's just a way better athlete. So that was hard. It's a hard pill to swallow because everyone's telling Lance did this and Lance did that. I'm like, fuck. I'm going to try to jump straight to the top rope from the ground and get to the second rope and bail. Like, he just had those amazing jumping powers. But I think. To answer now, I think one of the things that I learned that's really kept me relevant in a lot of ways, and vital to the business was I started working in 2016 when I went back to WWE. I started working with are our lights going off? Let's go. Are we still okay with these lights on?
Yeah.
I can turn it back on. Yeah. So I think what happens if we got reset. See, here's the real ghosts in the machine.
Alright, while we're doing that,
it's kind of cool stuff. Yeah. Do you like it like this?
No.
Okay, is that good?
Yeah. please, thank you.
That happens sometimes when it resets, everything goes to the motions. I went back to WWE in 2016, and I started working with Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn, Roman Reigns, Seth Rollins, Cesaro, and it was just like, I remember the first time we were with Seth Rollins, he did a tope, and then he did another one. Mm-hmm. And I was like, the way I was trained is you would never do that.
No.
Ever.
Right.
Why would you do two in a row? And then I started realizing, once again, get your head out of your ass. What can I learn from these guys? Oh, this is the new way of doing things. Now, not that I've never done a tope in my life, or if I have, it's been 25 years, but let's start doing things this way. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of revitalized myself to where I was like, man, these old kind of chains, I don't want to work with Shawn Michaels and Triple H and Kane and Undertaker anymore. Not that they're not amazing. I want to work with this new generation of guys because I like this vibe and this connection and this demo, if you will, this contrast of the guy from this generation working with the new helps them become bigger names because I'm working with them. Helps me become a bigger name because I'm working with those younger guys. It's all new matches. Mm-hmm. Same thing when I went to Japan. That's why I was like, you know, Kenny Omega. Never heard. I mean, I heard of him. Who is this guy? He's from Winnipeg. I'm from Winnipeg, this small little prairie town. Don Callis is commentating, and one of his best friends, also from the small prairie town. We end up going to sell out the Tokyo Dome and basically start AEW when Tony Khan saw the business that we did on the New Japan streaming side. I think it went up 300% or something because there was an alternative wrestling model, right? So that put me back on the map as a legit main event draw again. And then we start AEW, same thing. I don't want to work with, you know, Matt Hardy or Christian or nothing against those guys. They're great workers, but we've done that a million times. Mm-hmm. I want to work with, you know, Kenny and Cody, Orange Cassidy, MJF, Eddie Kingston, you know, all these guys that we've worked with over the last few months, all fresh. Yeah. I never had a match ever with Bryan Danielson. Maybe one that I can remember at a house show in San Juan, Puerto Rico. It's a whole new match. I'll do that one until the cows come home. Mm-hmm. But these other ones are all new matches. So staying relevant by learning from the younger guys helped me reinvent myself, not just from a personality standpoint, but from a wrestling standpoint as well.
Yeah. This comes to you just main event with Yuta. Really, this is a matchup we never thought.
Never thought we saw
in a million years, like 5 years ago. Never would have thought we would have seen that.
I think Jericho and Eddie Kingston. We never thought you would have seen that. And all these guys are all great workers. And yeah, sure, I beat Wheeler. You know, Jericho refuses to put young guys over. It's like I think being in the ring with me puts him over because we're in the main event of freaking Dynamite.
Yes,
and we're going toe to toe. And to me, that's how you start putting over guys. Winning and losing, he can beat me 100 times in a row. Doesn't make him a bigger star. What makes him a bigger star is hanging and being in those clutch positions and having people start to accept Wheeler Yuta as a main event guy. We've done it with Danny Garcia as well.
Yeah.
This is how people become connected with you. Mm-hmm. He's in the main event. He's in the main event. He's in the main event. Repetition, 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 repetition. Mm-hmm. Then when he wins, then it takes you to the next step.
Yeah, you get him familiar with that.
Yes,
yeah, with that routine.
You get him familiar of being in that spot.
Yes.
Of course Wheeler Yuta is the main event. He's been in 10 already, hasn't he? So that's something that we do really well in AEW is put everybody in these positions to where you have the potential to start growing, not just from wins and losses, but from the perception of where you are on the show and what kind of angles you're in. And perception is reality in the wrestling business.
It's like music. It's funny because I remember he was telling me about one time how Puff Daddy had a conversation with Biggie, and he was telling me, he's like, okay, I know you want to rap and say all these incredible things and, you know, these incredible wordsmith vocabulary things. You could do that on the album. The songs you put out, give me 3 basic records. Don't be extra difficult with what you're saying. Just say basic stuff.
Yeah.
You know, love it when you call me Big Pop, just say that.
Yeah.
Let me just keep it basic.
But see, we can all sing along with it.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? Exactly. And you
don't imitate it and have fun with it, right?
Right. Yeah. And everybody, let everybody just follow along and let everybody get an idea of what you're doing. Like you said, about just making it easy as possible. You want everybody to relate to you in a way to make it easier for the audience. And then on the rest of the album, you just do whatever you want to do. You know what I mean?
That's exactly, I mean, it's so true. And you can relate everything to music. I met Keith Richards once.
Oh, wow.
I hung out with him for 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was. And I had just seen this Rolling Stones pay-per-view. And they did that song, I'm going down, 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 down. And they all start trading solos. It's Ronnie Wood, it's Keith, it's John Mayer, who's a killer guitar player, it's Gary Clark Jr. And all these guys are just head cut. They're playing as fast as they can, and Ronnie Wood's got the slide, and he's a killer player, and then it's Keith's turn. Keith just goes up and goes, and he walks back, and I was like, that's the fucking
that's it.
I said to Keith, I mentioned that to him, he said, well, everyone was playing so busy, man, I wanted to pick one note and stick with it.
Yeah.
But I just had to make sure it was the right one. And that's great advice.
That's masterful in itself.
Here's one note.
Yeah.
Stood out.
Beat everyone else's notes.
Yep.
That's what wrestling is too, man.
To me, that's Sting running in and bat.
That's it.
Bat.
That's it. Having that match where you build and build and build and hit the finish. And like, listen, obviously it's a different world. You can't do Dory Funk versus, Jack Briscoe 1975, nor would you want to. But still keep that in mind, that one note, that one feel, that feel of something meant so much more than all this. And I still think the same when I watch a lot of matches in AEW. And listen, there's stuff that I could never even dream of doing. I'm not talking about that. It's putting the things in the right spot, which is something that we all heard from day one. All the old timers, your trainers, it's not what you do, it's when you do it. That rule will never go away.
Yeah.
Ever, 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 ever go away. Especially on U.S. television.
True, man.
That's amazing. Like, and I can see, even when when you come out and your theme song plays, everybody just immediately knows. They're singing it. They know.
And that's another thing, too. When I turned heel, we did the Jericho Appreciation Society. Rich Warden actually came up with a remix of Judas. Like, it's a little bit less sing-along-y, and it was different. Tony didn't want to do it. He wanted to keep the original song. And I got a lot of people going, well, if you're such a heel, why do you have a song that everyone sings to? And it's like, he had a great point. If we kill the song, you get 1 week of heat. And then what do you do for your music? Then you just got ring music. Mm. We have something that organically was created by our audience, AEW, where they started singing Judas. So do you cut your nose off to spite your face and take away one of the kind of the trademarks of our show just because I'm a bad guy? It's like, does it really matter either way? You're killing a great moment just because you don't want people cheering. And to me, that's like the whole concept of what wrestling is to get people cheering, is to get them involved. Once the match starts, the promo starts, I'll get the heat, whatever. But that song is so much a hallmark of Dynamite in AEW that to not play it just because I had turned heel would be a disservice to something that we created that's very special and very unique. And he had a great point. And as soon as he pointed it out, I was like, you're totally right. You really are. So, like you said, people just like to be involved with that. And they like to sing along.
They like to love. People want to get out of their house. Take their kids and families to these shows. They want to be involved.
Yeah. It's a sense of a community, a sense of team. And that's something with AEW, like once again, relating to music. I started listening to Metallica in 1985, right when their second record came out. And I was 14 years old.
Is that the blue cover?
Yeah. So I grew up with Metallica. And as Metallica got bigger and bigger and bigger, I took great pride in that. I was never the type of guy that's like, oh, Metallica, fuck, they shouldn't be playing arenas. No, they should be playing stadiums. They're the best band ever. And that's why when they are playing stadiums, I was there from the start. Mm-hmm. I had my membership card, in my head. I think our AEW fan base feels the same because they had the very cool moment in time where they could start with a wrestling company from the beginning. WWF started in, 80s and before that in the 40s.
Yeah.
WCW, NWA started in the 40s. You could start with AEW because it was such a great out-of-the-gate revolutionary moment. As the company grows, we have people from the start that are like, yes, this is our AEW. This is our wrestling company. And that's where there's so many tribalism. You're either a WWE fanatic, you're an AEW fanatic, and it's like trying to tell somebody that's a Muslim that Jesus is the way, or telling someone that's a Christian that Buddha's the way. You'll never be able to do that. So we have our line in the sand, WWE fans and AEW fans, and neither one I think are really going to stray too much. It's just now adding to the AEW fans with new ones. I think pretty much that's the real secret, and that's the test.
You know what's funny? That's funny. One quick thing. It's funny how you mentioned Metallica, because the way that I want to bring hip-hop and rock together for one quick second, and you look at how, like, James from Metallica, the lead singer, and when you spread to the second album, he was a kid.
Yeah.
Young kid. You know what I mean? Your early 20s, very young. And then and hip-hop, that's LL Cool J.
Yeah.
We see him from 18, from 16, 17, 18, and you see them both grow to where they're at now in their respective lanes. And a lot of people give them their credits, like the first, like, childhood stars for their genres.
They also get their criticism, too.
They get their criticism, too. Right.
As well. You know what's interesting to me, too, but in the rap world, though, so Metallica is still touring. But I could be wrong. Do you see LL doing shows anymore? Does he go on tour?
He did one. He threw his own show.
Does Ice Cube go on tour? You know what I mean? Does Ice T go on tour?
They bring each other.
They go out and go out? Because that's one thing.
They'll probably do
Because rock bands get in their 50s and 60s. That's when they're still drawing huge. I don't see a lot of rappers in their 50s and 60s. It's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because they all transition into acting, it seems. They go into become famous actors, you know?
I think, like, also, they're... We haven't really seen a lot of them grow old. We're now just seeing our legends grow old, which DJ used to say. We're just now seeing Snoop get old. We're just now seeing Jay-Z get old. We're seeing Nas get old.
Snoop still goes out, right?
Snoop does it whenever he wants.
Snoop can still sell out.
Instantly. Like, we're just now seeing 50 Cent get old. You know, that's our generation. Yeah. So we're seeing these guys get old.
50 Cent's actually 50.
50, F-I-T-Y.
I'll tell you, it was one of the, like, I have three kids, three teenagers, and they know what I do, but I'm just dad to them, which is fine.
Right.
But there's been a few moments where I became the coolest kid on the block, and one of them was when they found out that Snoop Dogg follows me on Instagram. I was like, see, here you go.
That's it.
I won my oldest over when Cena followed me.
Oh, there you go.
And then she was like, what? Oh, my God. No. Now you want to come to shows.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Okay. All right.
Yeah. So, man, this has been a great time with you. The light's been flickering, going on and off, but we still...
It's literally lightning like an alpha.
Don't take that out. Keep that.
Yeah, keep that light.
Conversation has been...
Fire. It's electric.
Thunderstorming, man. It's been awesome, man. Man, like, every time I get a chance to sit and talk with Chris, it's always great. We always, like, go into all these multiple different, like,
lots streams to discuss, for sure.
We didn't even get into movies, and we can go into, like, hours of discussion with movies.
Let's do part two.
Part two.
Yeah, three, pretty much at this point. I mean, that's how we talk, man.
Perfect.
But, man, thank you, Chris Jericho. Thank you for allowing us into your house, your kingdom.
My pleasure, humble abode. I'm glad you come inside after I pulled the river. You guys got drenched.
I was literally looking forward to doing it in the rain. Like, this is the first.
That's it. It's the rain. Absolutely.
Yeah. But, man, we got to have you back sometime, man, and have it do it in the studio. This Rope City.
Right.
Podcast. It's going to be a time.
Next time in Orlando, we'll do it.
Yes, for sure, man. TZ, you got anything to ride off with?
Yes. Speaking of streaming, if you go on the stream, Judas, make sure you stream that Sammy Xavier Guevara, too. That made that song. Thank you, Sammy, for showing me love for these years.
And congratulations, you just got married.
Yes.
Awesome. Did you do Sammy's song?
Yeah.
That was me.
That one goes Sammy Guevara.
Yeah, that's me.
That was, I like that one.
Hey, he knows it. I'm cool. I'm so late. Chris knows it. I'm good. So, thank you guys for all the support and love. And man, we're here, man. We're here with the GOAT, brother. We're here.
GOAT, man. So, best way to sign up.
Now you got to get the hell out.
Yeah, we do. You know what? I was going to do my closing line. I'm just going to leave. I'm out. Close.
Thank you, man.